More than 2 million Americans live behind bars in either prison or local jail, and nearly every discussion of how many people we imprison gets back to the racial imbalance. People of color are imprisoned in numbers much higher than their proportion in the general population. Then there's the issue of black-on-black murder at the core of Jill Liovi's book Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. In Los Angeles, where Jill lives and works, murders of African Americans by African Americans are common. The solving of such murders and the bringing of the killers to justice is much more uncommon. Jill Liovi is a longtime reporter for the Los Angeles Times with several awards for her work. Ghetto Side is her first book. Jill, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
So how many years have you spent on the police beat in L.A.?
You know, I think I started around 2002, and continued up until I completed the book in around 2012 with some breaks in there.
Have you gone back to that? Are you still working for the Times?
I am a reporter at the Times. I'm actually not covering a police-related beat at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the Homicide Report blog, because I understand you were instrumental in this beginning at the L.A. Times.
So the blog was something I started in 2006. It was a listing of all the homicide victims in the county. Each one got a blog item, stacked one on another as the days went by. The items varied, but they usually contained some very basic information about circumstances, time, place, manner of death, and the race of the and gender of the victim.
Was there, there are a couple of references in the book, Ghetto Side, about the fact that, you could actually open the L.A. Times some days before the Homicide Report blog started and hear about bombings in Beirut, for example, and see nothing about murders that actually happened in L.A.?
Yeah, and I think that is something that happens actually around the country in a lot of big cities. We had, in the biggest years, in the 90s, 2,000, some murders in Los Angeles County. Of course, that's larger than than the borders of the municipality, Los Angeles City. But it's simply impossible for any media outlet to cover all of those. And in the event, you know, so much of it was part of a syndrome that had almost become expected. It was, you know, called gang violence down in certain parts of the city, that it was, there wasn't a strong news angle that was very visible in a lot of those stories, and so they wouldn't get hit. We were covering about maybe 10% of the murders in LA County. You know, there's in the news business, there's always the man bites dog, you know, paradigm for how you do things. You want to cover the unusual stories. Well, these murders were very like each other. They happened, you know, 3 to 6 a day. And so it was hard to find a man-bites-dog story in those killings.
Oh, so if it were unusual, like a double murder or murder with robbery or murder with long chase or something, that would rise to the level.
Or low-propensity victims, child murders of children. I think in general, and this is everywhere in the country, tend to get more news coverage. Murders in very unexpected circumstances or places that where they rarely occur tend to get a lot of covered serial murders, which are, you know, very rare, obviously, but get a lot of news coverage.
So the title itself, Ghetto Side, comes from where?
You know, it was a term used by a young man who met officers on the street, and he identified to me as a gang member in Watts. It's something you occasionally hear that the cops had also picked up. In Los Angeles, there's a vertical north-south street running all the way through the length of South L.A., Main Street in L.A. In the old days, the real estate covenants, which were racially discriminatory and banned people based on race from buying homes in certain areas, the line for those ran along Main Street. And so they developed in L.A. the habit of saying, early on, as blacks were migrating to the city, of saying east side, west side, meaning east side of Main Street, west side of Main Street. There was a point where that boundary was broken, and blacks did begin to move to the west of Main Street. But because of that west side, east side is a common way of sort of framing the geography in South Central. And so the term ghetto side, I think, is a commentary on that. It means east side, west side, doesn't matter where you are in the hood, it's all ghetto side.
It's all ghetto side.
And what I talk about in the book is how similar all of these highly segregated black neighborhoods are all over Los Angeles County, and I think elsewhere in the country as well.
And the book does start macro before it goes micro. The macro part of the book is called The Plague, part one of the book. Part two is the case of Bryant Donnell, which we'll get to in time. But some of the facts and figures that just come out in the plague portion of the book, the distribution of homicide deaths in the population we know is uneven, but just how uneven?
Extraordinarily uneven. And, you know, the basic rule of thumb is the difference between black and white rates is hovered between fivefold to eightfold. Blacks are five to eight times more likely to die from homicide than whites are. What that means in real term is if you take the highest risk group, which is always going to be young men, 18 to 24-year-old black men, they had rates above 350 deaths per 100,000 in the early 90s. They're probably in L.A. County down to about 90 deaths per 100,000, maybe even 80 deaths per 100,000 today. Compare that to a national homicide rate of about four or five per 100,000. And actually, a rate for whites is even a little bit lower than that, and you get a sense of how outsized black homicide rates are. Two things for me that really sent me spiraling on this sort of searching path to figure out what was going on, that surprised me very early on this beat, was that those rates go back and back and back in time. It is not something that started with crack cocaine. It's not something that started with the Crips in L.A. or any of the modern sort of gang modalities that we talk about. It goes back to the 50s, the 40s. I think the way we counted homicides in this country gets pretty fuzzy, but there's quite strong evidence that it goes all the way back to the Reconstruction South. And then the other thing that really struck me was L.A. is a Latino city. It's at least 50% of the population is of Mexican or Central or South American descent. And yet the black homicide rate is much higher than the Latino rate, even though blacks and Latinos are highly integrated in these neighborhoods south of the 10 freeway in L.A.
Wow. More mind-boggling facts and some heart-wrenching stories coming up as well from Jill Leovi. Her book is Ghetto Side. Back on The Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Los Angeles Times reporter Jill Leovi, who's written a book called Ghetto Side, a true story of murder in America that takes a look at how much murder goes on in Los Angeles, particularly between members of the African American community, and how seldom those murders are solved and people brought to justice for them. The particular focus on some key cases in the book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in our listening area, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Jill, I think I'm probably in the third or fourth restatement of these figures because I did read them in the book. I did watch your interview on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. But having written them down as you said them, so even down to 90 murders per 100,000 population today, that's just so far out of whack with the chance of murder for the rest of the population. Is it four in 100,000?
Yeah, four or five in 100,000. That number is for the youngest, highest risk young black men in L.A. County. They're actually L.A. County Health Department numbers. The national rate for black men that age, I think, is in the maybe low 80s, I'd have to look at that. And it's, of course, been falling very rapidly. It's much better than it used to be. But the point is, this is a pile-up, a syndrome that really occurs in a very, very intense and concentrated way in a small population in the U.S. And I think if you read about murders in the newspaper, if you read about crime in general, you don't necessarily see that. In L.A., it's really a yin and yang. We have some very prosperous suburbs that are also included in the city limits. They tend not to be black neighborhoods. They tend to be white and Asian mixed neighborhoods. And the difference in the violent crime rates between those neighbors is really like different countries. They might as well be half a world apart by measure of how distinct they are in terms of crime.
And you mentioned this goes back all the way to Reconstruction South, and it seems like every era and corner of the country had its own nasty shorthand, like NHI in Los Angeles. What did that stand for?
I should say, you know, a lot of people are fixed on that in the book. I think that's sort of 1980s and before. I didn't hear it a lot in my era in the LAPD. I think that's passed away, but it stood for no human involved. And it actually meant sort of a range of marginal people who would get murdered. I've heard that it was applied to homeless people, applied to prostitutes, and, of course, underground black men who were very frequent murder victims. It meant that it wasn't a big deal. And there were sort of similar things, I think, in the second edition of the book. We included that the words population control were sort of a cynical joke that you'd hear in the courthouses back in the big years in the 80s and 70s and 80s, the idea that the blacks were killing each other and sort of eliminating themselves. It's an idea that goes way, way back into the South of the early part of the century, where there's a lot of commentary to the effect that blacks killing blacks was not a big deal, was not an emergency for law enforcement.
And even today, this is one of the other major factors in the macro portion of the book, is finding out that the solve rate for these murders is so low.
Right. I say in the book about 40%. That's from a count of all the murders that I had in a database over, you can take different periods of time, but basically over the last 20 years in L.A., it varies from year to year, and the ways we have of counting this are extremely crude. The federal statistics that are published on homicide clearances tend to be much higher than the reality of who's really going to prison for having committed homicide in the U.S. And so the idea that, 4 out of 10 murders were resulting in somebody going to prison, I think it's been pretty consistent in L.A. County. It's consistent across agencies. It's not just an LAPD thing. It's very, very difficult to solve these cases, and that tends to be kind of the threshold that things fall at.
What is the major obstacle, then? What are the major difficulties in solving the cases?
So it's the enormous one, the colossal one, as I quote a prosecutor saying in my book, and the one that really, I don't know if I've ever, and I've covered scores and scores of these murders, I don't know if I've ever seen a case where this wasn't an issue. The issue is the reluctance of witnesses to testify and their fear of standing up in court and pointing out killers. It is so rampant that it's very routine for people not to come to their door when detectives knock, or to yell at them through the window and say, go away, or to, open the door a crack and say, could you please come back at night so that my neighbors don't see you here? It's an ubiquitous fear, and the way we structure trials, there are various pretrial hearings and preliminary hearings. It can take a long time for things to go to trial. There's a tremendous problem of the witnesses initially being cooperative and then disappearing before the trial. And there's a low-level din, maybe not a violence against witnesses, but something I call in the book message sending, low-level intimidation, hard stares, rocks thrown at houses, things that indicate strongly to residents in the area that they better be careful if they're going to take on their neighbors in this regard.
And so it's not like they don't know their neighbors. I mean, you make that pretty clear in the book, that even as crime-ridden as some of these areas may be, people do know who each other are. And so it's not like there's really a lack of people who at least know somebody who probably saw something.
These are highly networked communities. Watts is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Los Angeles. Others have written about this much better than I, but when people are poor, they're often sort of half thrust into an economic underworld, an economic underground. It might not be selling drugs. It might just be, running unlicensed businesses, fixing people's cars on the side. A lot of victims especially older men, that their families would tell them, they were handymen. They just went around the neighborhood and did little odd jobs for people and did that for years. That's how they survived. There's a lot of barter and trade, and I'll give you a ride, or you can sleep on my couch, but help me with this. So people are actually, it's a communal setting. People are highly networked. There's a lot of close connections in these communities, and homicide is a crime of intimacy. It's about quarrels. It's about arguments, and you don't develop arguments with people unless you have those kinds of ties. And so it's another one of the factors that kind of produces, when the environment is so lawless, when people are depending on each other, especially economically, the stakes become very high for very small disputes.
And Jill, there's a really intriguing phrase that you put in here. Lawlessness is its own kind of order.
Yes, when there's a vacuum of law, it gets filled immediately. It's not just a state of nature. Instantly, people start to assert power, groups start to assert power. We see this all over the world, and that's one of the things I talk about in the book, that the groupings that we think of as gangs have their counterparts in gangs elsewhere in the world, and sects and factions. And I mentioned in my book, Russian peasants at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, that actually I think the government in Russia at the time outlawed gang membership because it was such a problem in these rural peasant communities that were very lawless. There's an order that's formed, leadership emerges, violence is power, and so there's always an economy of power, and if the state abandons it and leaves it around for someone else to pick up, it will get picked up, it will get used. People will use violence to get their way, to assert control over others, to amass resources. It's just the way we are as human beings. It's not a black thing, it's a human thing.
And so you mentioned this shadow legal system that kind of crops up in the vacuum of the actual power of the quote-unquote true authority. So is there a sense then that there will be some vengeance for a murder, that the justice will be served even though not through the justice system as we know it?
Absolutely. And there's all sorts of euphemisms for it. I think the most common one on the streets of L.A. would be taking care of business. We're doing some business, meaning taking care of settling scores and taking care of wrongs. I don't know what percentage of homicides are directly related to retaliation for other homicides. It's hard to tell when so many cases are unsolved. You don't get to learn in detail what the motives are. But I think it's substantial. Or, there's kind of there's a phenomenon of troublemakers, of people who have been hurting others or messing with other people's lives or maybe even robbing other people in the neighborhood for a long time, and it goes on and everyone's kind of secretly irritated with them and they never get arrested and they never go away, and lo and behold, one day they end up murdered by somebody and the police will go to the neighbors and they'll say, well, the street took care of it. It's what are you worried about?
Justice in a different system. Ghetto Side is the book by Jill Iovi, A True Story of Murder in America. She's a reporter at the Los Angeles Times. It's quite a gripping book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about black-on-black murder and how seldom it is solved, particularly in Los Angeles. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So obviously this is not just a book of statistics by any stretch of the imagination, and I'm selling it short at this point because you start off with some very specific cases right off the bat, and a very specific person, John Skaggs, a detective in the LAPD, who could not be more different from the community he polices.
He certainly looks different, he's a tall white man, he's very, very conspicuous as he goes around his job, walking through Alice and walking through the streets. He is somebody who really grew his craft working in Watts. He really develops an artisan's notion of what it should be in a situation where that division or precinct is about 8 or 9 square miles. When I was first down, they had 60 or 70 homicides a year and a crew of maybe, 8 detectives. So they were very, very overloaded. They had to work very fast. They got a ton of experience with exactly these kind of cases, mostly out of the public's view, unnoticed by their superiors, and it became kind of a calling for him that he would specialize in these particular cases, and he became quite skilled at it with an unusually high clearance rate for these kinds of conditions.
What kinds of things did he do then? I mean, because you've talked about some of the issues with, trying to knock on the door of people who might have seen something and, they yell at you to come back at night or won't talk to you at all. And so how did he work the neighborhood to get better results than other cops?
This is really fascinating because I think we have a tradition literature of the Sherlock Holmes, of the the deducing who the killer is from clues. And what I notice about Detective John Skaggs and some of the other very successful detectives who emerge in the book is they're all alike in one regard. They are extremely confident, calm people just by nature. And I actually think that's a very important point, because really what they're doing when they go around in these neighborhoods is convincing witnesses to talk, convincing witnesses to trust them. It is all about trust, convincing families to trust them, and to turn their burdens over to them, which in some metaphorical way is exactly what the law is supposed to be. We're supposed to be able to turn it over to the apparatus of the law, to not have the burden of avenging our own loved ones, to have the state take care of it for us. And so I think it's very significant that, you know, John Skaggs has a lot of skills. He was very, very energetic, really almost an eerie memory that he had that really helped him with his cases, and obviously a very organized, detailed person. But I would say his main trait, he's a very unequivocal thinker, even kind of a narrow thinker, very, very sure of himself, big, tall guy, and he just convinced people it was all right and that he was going to solve these cases and that they could talk to the police and the police would have their backs.
There's an account in here of the mother of a murder victim getting in his face, I mean, screaming at him. He's a very tall guy, so she really had to look almost straight up, she says. But he's so calm, he said a couple of years later, he never remembered that on their first meeting.
Yeah, well, John Skaggs has a very selective memory. He doesn't really remember anything that isn't about progress on his cases. It's something I've noticed about him over the years. But that's that is a trope of working South L.A. The cops who work there get screamed at all the time. There's so much frustration. People are very, very irascible with their police officers in these neighborhoods. It's one of the reasons why some police officers don't want to work there. And I actually think that that there's something healthy about that self-selection. The police officers who work in 77th and Southeast and Southwest divisions tend to work there because they actually like it, and they're rewards to them in that job. But there is this intense frustration that people feel toward the police, and it very often is of the form of, you know, you don't care, he's just another black man, he's just another black man down, the police are never going to do anything about this killing. It actually was one of my first, way early on before I knew John Skaggs well, long before I contemplated writing this book, he stood out to me because you know, I would always go to families after the homicide, and the detectives were very interested in that. They always wanted to know how it was if I went and spent the evening with a family and came back to the squad room the next day. And almost always the families said to me, I don't believe the police are going to do anything. I don't believe they'll solve the case. And so it was of no consequence to me when Skaggs had a double murder, Latino victims who were brothers, and I had gone to the mother, and she said, oh, the police, there's no way that the police are ever going to solve this case. I spoke in Spanish, as I recall. She was from Central America and didn't have a high opinion of police coming from where she came from. And I mentioned to John Skaggs, and he was really aggrieved by that when I said that to him. And I didn't think anything of it because everybody said, he says, no, you know, is that what she really said? Why does she think we're not going to solve it? And he came back to me a week later and said, I want you to know that I solved that case. And it really mattered to him that I, the LA Times reporter, know that he solved that case. So that was one of my very first encounters with him, and it sort of filed it away in my mind and thought about it later.
John Skaggs is not a young guy by police terms. So why is he still on the streets at age 45 plus in the era of this book?
Well, detectives tend to be older. It takes some years to get to be a detective in police departments, and you know, I think he's actually nearing retirement now. He can retire at different ages. He'll still end up retiring, in my view, relatively young. I actually think he was pretty much at his prime then. It you know, it takes, this is craft. Learning how to do detective work is not something you can really do in school. It has to be, it's a mentorship kind of skill set. You know, you got to have a mentor, you got to do it, you've got to practice your skills over a lot of cases. And so the fact that he had done that for many years and also done it in this high-volume context, this is a really important thing, because there are places in this country where police detectives might get one murder a year, right? It's very difficult to learn it if you're working that low a volume. But he was in a situation where he's working up to 20 cases a year. So I think that the Tinelli case really catches him at the height of his abilities. It does take, 10 or 20 years to learn how to be a homicide detective.
And the Tinelli case is actually the shooting death of the son of another detective, Wally Tinelli. We'll talk about the Tinellis when we come back and talk more with Jill Liovi. Her book is Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. We'll come back and talk more with her and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. 800-838-3760 throughout our listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Jill Liovi and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Los Angeles Times reporter Jill Liovi. She is the author of a book, Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America, which gives us both the macro view of black-on-black violence in Los Angeles and how seldom the murder cases there are solved. And it's not just in L.A., but in lots of parts of the country as well. And then some micro details as well about some individual cases and individual people with some real heart who really had some struggles to deal with in this book. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we just started talking about the Tinellis. Wally Tinelli, also an LAPD detective. And he, too, was somewhat unusual within the LAPD ranks in ways somewhat similar to John Skaggs. Tell us a bit about Wally.
So Wally Tinelli is, he's actually originally from Alabama, but grew up in L.A. He, is really the personality type who makes a great detective. He's, again, very confident, sort of calm person who just radiates a lot of certainty, extremely organized. He excels in homicide. He's somewhat older than John Skaggs, gets his start a little bit earlier. Also learns in the southern part of the city how to handle high volumes of these kinds of gang cases, street shooting cases, and eventually he is promoted to the elite RHD unit, which tends to cover sort of this rarefied stratum of murders. All along the way, he has maintained his house in a nice section of the 77th Street Division. Well, this is a cause of some comment by his peers because most LAPD officers do not even live in the city, let alone in the highest crime division or precinct in the city. But Wally Tinelli does. He does for a lot of reasons. He grew up around there. He has family around there. It's a nice neighborhood where he lives. But he also lives there out of some conviction and principle that that's the right thing for a police officer to do, to live among the people that most need policing. And so what happens in the book is that he's raised his three children, sent the older two off to college. The youngest, Bryant, has just graduated from Catholic school, is walking in daylight near the home with a friend on a Friday evening. And a car pulls up, another young black man jumps out, fires a gun, and kills him. And he falls on the lawn, is transported to hospital, and dies shortly after.
What was the motive, do we know?
Motives are hard. It's hard to get to the bottom of things. The killers generally aren't talking a lot in these situations. But it's pretty evident that Bryant Tinelli was just an easy target. He was just, as the police like to say, in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was a young black man walking on the street in a neighborhood where there was a local black gang, most of the members of which were young black men. So when the rival gang members drive up and they see a young black man on the street, well, that's good enough. He's a good enough proxy for whoever they're trying to hit. And so he's killed. This is a very, very common scenario for killings in L.A. Many, many victims in what are in so-called gang-related shootings have nothing to do, either nothing to do with gangs themselves, which was the case for Brian Tinelli, or if they did, it had nothing to do with why they were targeted. They were still, you know, innocent victims, although I dislike that term.
Well, you know, that the term gang-related is something that the police have been using even in this area for, you know, 25 years now, and it's always hard to pin down what do you mean gang-related.
Well, yeah.
And of course, there's the whole scare term. Thing
it
about gang.
Yeah. It doesn't mean a lot. It doesn't, and it means there's always an argument. You know, the Justice Department distinguishes between argument and gang and drug. Well, it's either an argument about gangs, it's an argument about drugs, or it's an argument about you danced with my girl at a party. I mean, it's all the same phenomenon of argument shootings, and all of those things get mixed up. Lots and lots of gang-related killings in L.A., for example, are infighting. They're in-house murders of people in the same gang. Well, generally, they were drinking together or they had some argument over something personal, and that's actually the underlying reason for those homicides.
So where they might have actually thrown punches, they happen to have guns, and so that makes the whole way of settling the argument easier.
Well, a heck of a lot of punches are thrown, too. There's a lot of, there's just fighting on a lot of different levels. You know, it's very interesting. There are people who have gone as far as to suggest that gangs are actually an attempt to organize some of that violence as a means of suppressing it, that they're pseudo-governments, in a sense. And that if everybody was fighting for themselves all the time, you might actually have more violence. I don't know if that's the case, but it shows kind of a way of thinking about this that I think is different than the conventional idea of gangs being just sort of this perverse pathological tendency of some people who irrationally engage in this. I mean, that's one of the points of Ghettocide is that, you know, think of the frontier. This is very much like a frontier setting. People are, the conditions result in people behaving differently. It's not inherent in the people or inherent in what people like to call culture or the way they think. This is what happens in frontier settings or in lawless places.
So it's really a way to just collectivize energy, make sure that people have drawn together in some sense for protection, but it also ends up then with rival factions that are going to do things to inflict stuff on each other.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. The projects in L.A. are kind of notorious, but if you actually look at the crime numbers, the individual housing projects, the housing developments for subsidized housing, tend to have less homicide right in the middle of them, and most of the homicides that occur are around the edges of them. Well, the reason for that is it tends to be one gang that will dominate the housing projects, and whatever murders do occur are usually in-house fights between those gang members, but no rival is going to ride into the middle of Nickerson Gardens and start shooting. It's protected by the gang. You see what I mean? So mm-hmm. There is organization to this world.
You're not really getting into at this point. We haven't gotten into the whole point of, you know, how do you undo this? But there got to be some questions that come to mind about how do you even begin if you got a system where these people draw together because they, and pardon me for using the term these people, working on the fly here, but they draw together into gangs because they're taking up for what they believe is a vacuum of protection and justice. So they won't trust the existing justice system, and likewise, the existing justice system doesn't really trust them.
Well, and would you trust the justice system? And the 40% clearance rate for homicides are just one thing. There's four or five serious injury shootings for every homicide that ends in a fatality, and I think the clearance rate for those is around 25%. So if you're thinking 8 out of 10 of these shooting cases is actually going to get solved by police, how comforting is that? When you think about whether you have to shift for yourself in terms of self-protection. So that's why I argue in the book, you know, everything starts with our response to violence. The most serious violence is homicide, and I think secondarily these serious assaults. It's why the story in the book, and the book does follow this narrative of John Skaggs investigating the killing of Brian Tinelli. It's actually a parable to me for how this should work. John Skaggs represents a kind of vigor that I think historically we haven't had in our criminal justice system for this end of the problem, reacting appropriately to assault and homicide, solving the murders, holding individuals accountable, and putting what we need to put into that effort, because that's what he does when he finally gets a hold of the Tinelli case and starts to pursue these killers. We have a real love affair with prevention and predictive policing and proactive policing, and a lot of words that start with P. And I think we have to stop and think, what is law? What is it for? What human need is it answering? And if the these people thing, you're right to say it, because these people are all of us. And we are all, I'm very sad to say, these people. Think about being in a fifth grade classroom in public school and having the teacher say, the bullies in the class can now do whatever they want to everyone else in the classroom, and I'm going to walk out of this room and lock the door, and you're stuck in there with them. How long would it take you to gather some friends around for self-protection and have a little click? Mm-hmm. It would take you about 5 minutes, right?
Right. That's a great analogy, too. We have a caller who's been waiting for quite some time. I want to invite him in. Jacob in Springfield, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jill Leovi, the author of Ghetto Side.
Hi, I wanted to bring up to mind the civil rights movement. And we know it was earned by a lot of violence and blood and martyrs, deaths. But they actually have the monument. It's maintained as a pantheon in Montgomery, Alabama, by the Southern Poverty Rights Center. But the total number of deaths, starting in 1954 when the Supreme Court declared school integration illegal, to the time of Martin Luther King dying, the total number of deaths is 40. And they really stretched to try to get those martyrs, everything from Mississippi Burning to, you know, the bombing in Alabama. Mm-hmm. But on a typical night in the United States, maybe that many people die on a weekend night, in the black population. And I want to just point out what I see as an agenda with the ACLU and the NAACP and the Southern Poverty Rights Center. They really don't care about murders. They only care about trying to get an agenda with, you know, integration and civil rights, and which is good. But in the long term, if you're an 18-year-old male and you're going to die before you're going to hit 18 because of street violence, you really don't care if you could vote at age 18, mm-hmm. And I want to ask, with this new Pasco shooting and this Trayvon Martin shooting and this Ferguson shooting, where you get thousands of protesters polarized on this issue of police violence and, policing against blacks, mm-hmm. but how do they feel about, just the standard run-of-the-mill black ghetto shooting that happens that's killing more blacks than segregation ever did?
Mm-hmm. All right. So responding to things other than the stuff like the Ferguson shooting. Thanks for the comments, Jacob. Appreciate that. Jill, has a lot to take in there. Any particular direction you want to go here?
Well, I'd say a couple things. One is I have spent years and years now doing most of my reporting in largely black neighborhoods of Los Angeles, and my impression is just the opposite. I tend to find that the people I meet there are very concerned about this and wonder why the rest of the world isn't, and they talk about it very openly all the time. I think that this is all of a piece. There's a reason why police shootings are so sensitive. It is astonishing to go back in history and see how many black people were shot by police. You really do see in the history of the South, particularly that transition from Reconstruction to Redemption, when sort of ex-Confederates took back the governments of the South. They used the police to intimidate blacks, to keep them from voting. There were lots and lots of killings of blacks with impunity by whites, which is sort of what sets up this whole kind of lawlessness around black lives. You make black lives cheap when you're trying to deny blacks their rights under the Constitution. That's what was happening in the 1870s, 1880s, and after. in the U.S. So it is all of a piece. I guess the other thing I would say is that I don't think we've, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount of concern in black communities. I think there's actually concern about this outside, you know, Watts and parts of South L.A. where there's high numbers of shootings. But we haven't really had a vocabulary for how to talk about it. We have a lot of old memes and ways of thinking about this that tend to go in the direction of, I think, moralizing or talking sort of foggily about people's culture as if black Americans have a culture that really is fundamentally different than white Americans, which I don't think. We have one history. We are one people. There are profound disagreements about how to interpret that history. But we haven't really had a language or a framework for how to address that, and that's part of the reason that I try to use comparative context in the book and to talk a little bit about Northern Ireland, to talk about the favelas in Brazil or the slums of certain Latin American cities, other places in the world where you see this phenomenon of very, very high homicide rates, and to understand that for historians and international scholars, it's commonplace to talk about legal structures. It's sort of odd that we don't. In the U.S., you know, Baghdad, after the U.S. invasion, had a soaring homicide rate, and there was lots of news coverage to the effect that some of that was not political. Some of it was feuding. Some of it was vengeance. Nobody talked about, you know, families or gang culture or hip-hop music when we looked at that soaring homicide rate. Obviously, what was going on there was a problem of government, a problem of the state.
Wow, the book is just so compelling on so many levels and just a very, very thorough work. Jill Leovi is the author of Ghetto Side, A True Story of Murder in America. Jill, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you.
It's been good to have you.